Greg, so after the night shift, right, you obviously moved on. So talk to me about the first time you got involved in contract negotiations. Now, let me say before you answer that question, we Europeans, we have really no idea, do we, about what labor relations contract negotiations are like in the United States. It's like, no, it's a world unto itself.
It's completely different, Tom. And I guess maybe just for, you know, just for some context to remind everybody, right? The issue with a collective agreement in the United States is that it is comprehensive and it's all negotiated at once. And so, you know, when I take a look at it and you think about all of these issues that built up when I was on third shift and all the grievances and all the complaints and all the issues with the contract administration that came up, all of the issues and concerns get boiled down into this one period of negotiation. Excuse
Well,
me.
let me just jump in with a question. Is an American collective bargaining agreement a legally binding contract?
Yes, it is absolutely a legally binding contract, which is something that people tend to forget, and they'll often treat other contracts with greater veracity than the collective bargaining agreement, but it's got equal weight. I mean, it's absolutely binding, and it captures it's it in theory captures all the agreements between the parties, and they all expire at once.
Is it enforceable in court?
Yes.
You know, I mean, you know, I know I'm not just talking about the National Labor Relations Board. I'm talking about the normal courts. You can go to court, can you?
Some of us have spent a good deal of time on the witness stand in federal court. Yes. It absolutely is. And that's a good point. I mean, you take these things, they are agreements between two parties that are as binding as any other contract that a company enters into. And people often don't want to think about it like that because they'll look askance at, well, that's just a nuisance getting in the way of my operation. But no, the commitment that you've made not to subcontract or, you know, to follow other provisions of the contract to use seniority or not to lay off. All of those things are absolutely enforceable, both through the National Labor Relations Board and then ultimately through the courts.
Okay, so listen, tell me about your first contract negotiation. Who was it? What was it? You know, was there late night drinking involved?
Oddly enough, no. And so the first contract negotiation, and it was a really interesting situation because I left Connecticut and I went to our automotive business in Ohio. And it was called United Technologies Automotive. It was a factory that made switches and relays. There were about 1,200 people in the factory, also represented by the machinists who I'd been dealing with back in Connecticut. But it was a completely different world.
So when you say the machine, when you say the machinist, that's the International Association of Machinists, IAM or whatever they're called, is it?
Yes, that's correct. Yep, that's right. And they're one of the largest unions here in the United States.
So basically they're an engineering union.
They represent production and maintenance folks, typically in manufacturing. Yeah. Yep. And so I went out there and it was a really different model. And I sat down with the district guy and he said to me, look, I know that we could ask for $1 an hour. And I know that you might even give us $1 an hour, but I also know that the Monday after we sign the contract, you'd back the trucks up and move the factory. And so I had come from this relationship where it was very confrontational. The institutions were always clashing and walked into this new environment where you've got a union that gets the value of the jobs in a rural portion of Southwest Ohio. And so I walked in where the union had already rejected the contract twice. And so
Now,
they've
sorry,
gone through.
can I get just a question? What year was this?
This is 1989.
Okay. Now, I can just back up a little bit, right? In 1981, Ronald Reagan fired 13,000 air traffic controllers.
Yeah.
Right? Was the whole climate of labor relations changing in America during the 80s as you were cutting your teeth in these type of negotiations? Were unions fearful? Was, you know, and of course, as we're heading into 1989, we're beginning to head into the era of, you know, big offshoring and.
Yep.
So suddenly, were you finding that the dynamics were beginning to change, that the guys on the other side of the table knew that their leverage was disappearing?
I think, Tom, I think it's a very good question. I think it was sort of the beginning of the end of the movement, right? If you think about the labor movement as a whole, and you think about the strangeness of the 1970s, right? So if we step all the way back and you think about the 1970s, bring with it, you know, sort of the tail of the Vietnam War, and then the aftermath, paying for the war, leads to all this inflation, and price controls get unleashed. And so inflation is in the teens all through, and unions still have a lot of power. And in fact, manufacturing in the United States from an employment perspective peaks in 1979. And so unions who are steeped in manufacturing still feel like they've got a lot of strength. And the movement is still pretty strong as they're reacting to these social ills of unemployment being high, right? This stagflation where the economy is not growing, but inflation is high. It's this really weird mix. Then you get to 1981. You've brought Reagan in. Obviously, a conservative move starts through, and he fires the air traffic controllers. I think the movement looks around and says, hey, any support we had at a federal level for this big, broad movement in America, it just disappeared. I mean, literally overnight. And I think what that did is that ends up pushing the discussions. It pushes the dynamic. It pushes the fights really down to the factory level because they see they're not going to win under Reagan, right? Because you've now got Reagan for two and the first Bush. So you've got 12 years of a conservative National Labor Relations Board. You've got 12 years of conservatism looking at labor overall. And I think that did have an impact. And what I walked into, you know, at Pratt & Whitney on the shop floor and the adversarialism we had there was an issue of local people really trying to hold on to what was being lost at the top levels. I mean, it was really different.
So let me sort of join a dot here. So during the 1980s in the United States, the same we find in the UK with the miner strike and so on. What you have was conservative administrations taking on the power of organized labor. And you know, that was a sort of a knockdown, drag them out, bloody bare knuckle fight. But then suddenly from 1989 onwards, China becomes available as a location to move plants to, and suddenly Mexico and India for services and Central and Eastern Europe. And was that another dynamic that you then saw coming into play?
Yeah. So I think, and I'll step back just a little bit from that, right? Because there's first of all this move from the northern industrial states into the southern right-to-work states where people can't be compelled to join a union even if they're represented by it. And that's sort of the first move. That's the chase the low-cost labor move that way. And then the next piece is Mexico and NAFTA comes into play. And so Mexico becomes the next great fear, right? So Ross Perot in his presidential campaign talked about the great sucking sound of jobs moving into Mexico. And then China opens up. And China really opens up in 01 with its entry to the World Trade Organization. And then all those jobs that went to Mexico, all of a sudden 200,000 jobs in the maquil industry go to China.
Can I ask you a question? When Ross Perot talked about the great sucking sound, was he wrong?
So I was in El Paso, Texas at the time, and I was working over the border in Mexico every day. And I would say that what people had missed in that whole conversation is the sucking had already happened to a great extent. So I don't think NAFTA in and of itself unleashed a lot because there were already agreements between the two countries that allowed for the entire border region to be producing goods to be shipped back into the United States with nothing but some tax on the value add. There clearly it was more because it became easier, And Mexico never established itself as a tremendous market for products from the United States because they could be produced in Mexico. So he wasn't entirely wrong, but I think what was missed was what had already happened, right? It was a migration south and then further south.
I'll stay away from the politics, but from a labor relations perspective, you're a sharp guy. You're sitting at the table with the union guys. Do the union guys now know that their leverage, the coin of phrase, is disappearing south?
Yeah, I think they did. So I'm going to jump back to that first negotiation where the union guy says, "Look, I know we could ask for more, but you just move the factory." And that was a piece of it. He knew that first of all, the factory could be moved quickly, and it could be put places that were even lower cost. And that realization sunk in, and this dynamic started to happen that there were union leaders who believed in the strength and the importance of the jobs, and then there were union leaders who sort of threw their hands up and said, "Well, it's going to happen anyway. And so I'm just going to get all that I can for as long as I can. Right. And I think that becomes a really interesting shift over the course of the next couple decades as we start to look at plants going to Mexico and plants going to China and plants going elsewhere, because some union leaders try early on and they try to make concessions that will make the factories work and allow them to keep the jobs. And others just sort of throw their hands up and say, "We can't compete with Mexico. We can't compete with China. We shouldn't even have to compete with those two. But let's just build the best separation package that we possibly can."
Well, let me ask you a question. The future of manufacturing in the United States, you saw what happened in the 80s. You saw what happened in the 90s. Maybe the sort of the days of globalization are over. And I'll come on to talk about your wider European and global experience in a few minutes. But I mean, are the dynamics changing again? Are we seeing the end of globalization? Are we going to see jobs coming back into America? And if that happens, are we going to see a revival in manufacturing unions?
So look, the work that will be done here in any high-cost country, in my mind, short of maybe, as we're seeing with the pandemic, maybe some absolutely sort of critical to public safety kinds of items, I don't think there's going to be any resurgence of manufacturing in any high-cost country that's going to result in any significant amount of jobs. So work that comes back, right, you're gonna look at it a couple of ways. The labor's either got to be super high value add, where it takes such a critical skill with a lot of discretion to do the job that you can do it in a high cost area. Or to the extent that it's not that kind of work, companies are going to employ technology and capital to replace labor. So, I was on a plane with a guy who had a business making irrigation systems, right? Not a high tech thing, but he had sourced them to China. And his logistics issues of getting these sort of light but bulky products back to the U.S. were problematic. And he said, "So I found a company that would make them here in the U.S. In China, there were 20 people working on the product in this factory that was set up to do lots of different manufacturing. When he sourced it onshore here, it's being done in San Antonio with technology and two people." I mean, that's the kind of thing that will happen, right? We have seen, when I walked into the first factory I ever was really in East Hartford, there were lines of people working on machines performing a single operation. Those entire lines had been replaced with a $3 million multi-axis machining center now, where one person runs it on each shift. I mean, that's what we can do. Now, that creates this tremendous bifurcation of the lower skilled jobs or the people who don't have those skills. There's a big question. What are they going to do? But then the folks on the other end are going to do very well. The people who sort of can fix the machines and make sure that they keep running and program those machines, there's a good future in it for them. But that's going to be a big challenge. So is there going to be a big resurgence? I don't think so. Are unions going to come back with those few jobs? I don't think so. And where I think the unions have absolutely missed the show, because manufacturing's gone down since its peak in 1979 by sort of 5 million-ish jobs. And unions haven't chased the service jobs, where over 50 million jobs have been added. I mean, that's the failure. Mm-hmm. If you're a union, you've got to adapt. You've got to demonstrate the flexibility and the value proposition to get those people in the industries that you don't represent and get them on the table.
Oh. On a night shift to contract negotiation, and then suddenly you realize that there was a world outside of America and it was different. And so, you know, when did you first sort of, you know, get your passport and leave America and find out about this wider world?
Yeah, you know, I think the Mexico assignment, which was 91 to 93.
Mexico doesn't count. I'm talking about the real world.
But I got to say this because people really believe that, Tom. And while I wasn't assigned overseas, and I got to go home to my house in El Paso, Texas every night, Mexico is completely different. And people, there was always this assumption, you know, people said, oh, I went on holiday in Cancun, I understand Mexico. No, you don't. You know, it was completely different. The system was different. And it was great. So that was sort of, you know, that was my first incursion. And there were lessons there about sort of taking an interest and understanding and trusting the people on the ground. And then this idea of demonstrating value to them, because there's always got to be a quid pro quo. There's got to be, you know, something that is in it for them in order for them to trust you, to open up, to share, to provide information. Right. And I think those are all really important things that you learn wherever you're based when you're working in another country. My real rest of world experience then kicks in when I go to Carrier in 2002. And
For those who are not familiar, Carrier is one of the biggest air conditioning unit manufacturers in the world, if not the biggest.
Right.
Yep. And you find their units in apartment blocks. You see them on big trucks as they go down the highway and so on. That's there.
Yeah. And Carrier had locations, they had distribution, they had manufacturing, you know, spread across the world. So that was the first place that I really get into it and have global labor relations responsibility. And I think the interesting thing that you get into there is that you see these different systems. And as you and I have talked, you know that I sort of distill things down to, you know, the lowest common denominator, and hopefully it's a high common denominator about how to think about these things. And that's when I really woke up and understood that you don't need to know everything in every country, but you've got to take an interest. You've got to be on the ground to develop the relationship with the people that you're going to trust. You've got to make sure that you get multiple opinions. This is back to the concept of trust but verify. Because if you talk to the lawyers, they're going to give you one answer, and you talk to a consultant, they're going to give you another, and then you talk to the folks in your facility, and they're going to tell you, well, this is how it works here. And none of them are necessarily the right answer for any given situation, but by triangulating, you can start to work together to come up with a strategy that's going to get you to whatever you need to do, whether it's improving a factory, getting through a wage negotiation, or shutting it down.
Okay, so, you know, what was the first big learning experience when you went global? You know, where was the first time you ran up against, holy shit, I got to deal with this?
Korea. There's no question. It was South Korea was the first big sort of oh shit moment, when we had 1,000 people walking around the streets out in front of the factory during a wage negotiation. And I was sitting 12,000 miles away, sitting in my office with the president of Carrier, walking back and forth every day, looking at me and saying, so what now, Rick? You realize we've got a factory shut down with 1,000 people.
And these will be 1,000 people walking around with the headbands and
with headbands, shaving their hair, sending it to the managers, And, you know, oh, by the way, with the threat of the HR manager being tossed in jail if he violates local labor law. And
fair enough.
Yeah. And so that creates, you know, that creates a situation that took me back into just sort of understanding the context for what's going on. I'd been there. I knew it. And I just want to say, I think it's important to have, for me anyway, to have seen a play, to understand sort of what it feels like in the sense of how, first of all, what the work is and how the relationships are between employees and their work and their supervisors and the company to try and think about what's going on right now.
And then you thought Korea was bad and then you went to France.
We had some interesting experiences in France, and you know, absolutely love tires burning out in front of factories. It's just a thing, but it's different. The thing that I always found most frustrating about France is the uncertainty, right? I sort of always said, look, you go to Germany and everything works, including the labor system most of the time. I mean, it works, and there is a schedule, and things stay on schedule. In France, the bureaucracy had been built in order to slow things down. And people knew, when we talk about leverage, as you asked in the last session, you talk about leverage. Folks know how to use the system as leverage to get what they want. And that's either getting more time, getting more in the social package, getting more in a negotiation.
You know, you say that, you see, Rick, from an American, let's get this thing done perspective. You know, is the French approach of let's slow this down and think about it necessarily a bad thing?
Okay. It depends on your perspective. So I come back to, as a business person.
As an American business person.
As an American business person. What are the things I want? I want cost, I want speed, and I want quality. And if you slow it down, you're adding cost and you're decreasing speed, right? So that's what I want. So purely from a business perspective, an American business perspective, is it bad? It's uncertain and it's slower. It adds cost. Yeah, it's bad.
But look, you know, you can't hurry the making of champagne. There are some things in life that just do not respond to, you know, let's get it done yesterday.
Well, this idea of being able to accept, understand, and sort of translate that process back is one of the great challenges of a global labor relations leader, right? Because I still think about a closure of a factory in Germany where I was dispatched to go sort of pressurize the situation to make sure that we were getting it done. And I distinctly remember I get on the ground and we've got a really good guy on the ground doing the work. And I went to the works council meeting with him and everything was going as it should. The conversation was right. Everything was correct. And I got back and I called my American supervisor and he said, what happened? And I said, conversation went, company got what it needed to on the table. The union's considering things. They'll be back in 2 weeks. He said, no, they won't. You get them back in the room now. I said, well, the room is 150 kilometers from here, so that's not happening. He said, no, get them back in the room tomorrow then. He said, they need to continue this process. We need to get it done. And I said, that's not the way this will get done. And And that was one of the two times in my career where my job was threatened.
You managed to survive that, did you? Yeah.
I managed to survive it. Yeah. Yeah. We had a conversation about managing the process and managing the expectation in a way that would get to the result we wanted. And we were able to do that without throwing a hand grenade in the room.
I remember a conversation with an Irish colleague, and you probably know who I mean, and go back many years, and when I, one of the reasons behind starting BEAR, the Brussels European Employee Relations Group, was we were having a drink together and he said, Tom, can you please tell me how the hell, and he didn't use exactly those words, how the hell do I explain this to them in Palo Alto?
And that's the trick, because we have a, there is an American business mentality, right? Mm-hmm. It's cost and speed. Go, 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 get it done and deliver. And the biggest challenge is explaining to people that it doesn't matter where you go. If you take the time to understand the process that's required, and if you take the time to understand who has the relationships to drive that process, you can get what the business needs accomplished anywhere, anywhere.
Okay, so look, we've got a few minutes left, and if I was talking to you in situation, you'd now be on your second bottle of wine, because I know you well, and I'd be on my second glass of water. You know? the question I would put to you is this. If you were talking to a young Rick Waters today, you know, looking at the start of their career, would you say to them, go into labor relations?
Yeah, I would. You know... It's been fascinating. Over 35 years, I went back and forth between HR and labor and sort of always came back to labor as the thing that I love. I think, first of all, inside the HR function, labor relations may be the piece that can have the greatest influence on the effectiveness of large portions of the population that don't get heard a lot, right? I mean, you think about production and maintenance workforces. In HR, we talk a lot about executives and a little bit less about managers and those poor folks on the shop floor. Well, that's kind of left to the labor relations folks. I would also say that it's got to be at a global focus, because in the U.S., right, we're 6% of people are represented. But globally, the number is a lot different, particularly when we get into Europe. And some of the best labor relations folks I've ever met are those folks in HR in Europe, because labor and HR are integral. They're not separated. It's not something that people don't want to get their hands dirty with. They're just involved in it because it's ingrained into the overall process. And so when you think about the ability to go and attack different problems that come up and identify new solutions, the creativity that you can exercise in the labor relations role is one that sort of got my juices flowing, got me excited, you know, every day. When I wasn't banging my head against the wall because we were having trouble moving, you know, moving through things. But it was the creativity, the ability to get to know and work with and develop relationships and make those relationships work on behalf of the company and for the benefit in most cases of our employees that I think makes it a tremendous career.
Final wrap up question. Do you understand this social media stuff?
Well, I guess I could probably Twitter a tweet, but not as well as you do, Mr. Hayes.
Well, yeah, indeed. So, you know, Mr. Waters, if we were in Sitges at the moment, Felipe would be sticking his head around the door telling us our time was up, but that there was a bottle available for us in the bar. So why don't we do what we always do at the end of a Berg session in Sitges and adjourn to the bar for that aperitif. You know, Rick, thanks very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us over these sessions. And for those of you listening, you know, see you next time on Baird Bites. And in the meantime, stay as safe as you can be. Thank you all.